Carrie Newcomer wrote this. Riding my bike down a narrow country road, to one side a dense forest, on the other side a wide summer meadow. Then, right there beside me, a graceful young doe was bounding in beautiful, unhurried leaps. And for just a moment, we were two deer running together in the blue evening light. Then, with a burst of speed, she dashed in front of me and disappeared into the woods, leaving me breathless with a feeling of visitation, of holy communion, like I'd been touched ever so briefly by something wild and unbroken. Since that moment, the world has felt less weary, like anything and everything is still completely possible.
When I entered Union Theological Seminary, to say I was in over my head would be a laughable understatement. I was a decent student in undergrad, but even to my own frustration, habitually underproving myself and wasting most opportunities in only the expert way an 18-year-old can. So when I sat at that long cafeteria table at Union in a hall filled with marble and Gothic structure, Harry Potter, I thought to myself, I didn't need a sorting hat to put me in my place. Heretical Catholics and African Methodist Episcopal students already in clerical collars and atheists praying with gratitude before taking a bite to eat, and on it went. These, my classmates, each sharing their story as to why they chose this school, how they had to fight to sit in on such and such a class, classes that I just happened to see on my schedule, and with this epic professor or another, names I had never heard of before, I shut up and listened quickly. It was from that quiet seat, begging my brain and heart to be like sponge-like capabilities, that I watched as the thin, hunched-over, sweaty man of James Cone pace and preach the lectures he gave. Dr. Cone, as you may have heard, died in April. He was the founder, the creative first voice of what we call Black theology, wherein any illustration of God that does not explicitly and concretely identify with the oppressed is not only false, but an image then of the oppressor. In Cone's words, the Black theologian must reject any conception of God which stifles Black self-determination by picturing God as a God of all peoples. Either God is identified with the oppressed to the point that their experience becomes God's experience, or God is a God of racism. Blackness of God, he continues, means that God has made the oppressed condition God's own condition. This is the essence of the biblical revelation. By electing Israelite slaves as the people of God and by becoming the oppressed one in Jesus Christ, the human race is made to understand that God is known where human beings experience humiliation and suffering. Liberation is not an afterthought, Cone says, but the very essence of divine activity. Did you hear that? So basically, Cone is making us understand the story of a God who, in radical action, came into the world in human form for the sake of saving his chosen people. Many of you know that story already. But Cone pushed us further to hear that what was radical was not the human form of God's choosing to come to the world, but rather choosing to come to the world essentially as a Black slave in early America, making enslaved peoples the chosen ones, a God of the oppressed, America as empire, and harder still, as oppressor. It was Cohn who taught me the Bible's not just relevance, but prophetic voice for today. How ancient stories are not so ancient for some. It was Cohn who, in his flesh and in his voice before me, taught me that there are prophets still born and teaching, how his life and works was the cause for theological and social disruption. It was Cohn who nonchalantly offered that in wearing a cross around one's neck, symbolic of public punishment, reminder by the state of the everyday repercussion for those who stole bread, and those who spoke truth to power, and those who were differently minded, and those whose skin or religious practices differed from the vision of the empire. To wear a cross around one's neck was to wear a beautified lynching rope strung on a necklace. It was a good 3 years to steep into the thought and mandate that my seminary afforded me. But I learned pretty quickly what I would use in my ministry and what could be forgotten. And then also what I would be taught to forget. For the first few years of professional congregational ministry, it really was all a lovely thought and spirit exercise. I ran Bible studies and classes at the local prison. I met weekly with the elders of the church to watch and discuss the retired PBS show, Religion and Ethics, during the George W. Bush years. Marriage equality and ending the wars begun on 9/11 were our fights. Trans kids spoke on panels. We talked of race in hidden language like the journey toward wholeness. It certainly wasn't easy, but it was different. I didn't have to think much about Cohn's work anymore, no more than with pride that I got to study with him, no more than to name drop or assure a search committee that I was educated and diversely so. Yes, my worldview, my ministry was informed by his lessons, that liberation promise, the God of the oppressed, but my people didn't talk much of God. And I didn't hear us speak or ache or cry out for a word on liberation. And heaven's not about America as the empire. I texted Stephanie a few days ago, the Lutheran minister who is Tobias's middle name namesake. "Well, the world is ending, I guess," I said to her, "and we have to preach a good word while it happens." Do you have a good friend who puts your cynicism in check? Who calmly calls you on your spirit's self-inflicted demise? If you don't, I urge you to go out and get one today. Stephanie wrote back a simple and calm retort. "I guess I think of it as the empire falling," she said. And then later, "The way to liberation, Kim, won't be rainbows and warm milk with cookies." In those few words, Stephanie reminded me of the way I had entered this life, this work, this intention that was ministry. I was called to be a preacher in Dr. Cohn's class, given a moral compass and a charge to take seriously the plight of my fellow humans if I was to respect the tool that is the pulpit. I was corrected that an exercise in thought and spirit was a club, and that a church, a congregation whose beliefs caused mandated, erected action was a religion. Just because I had taken a deep, depressed rest in the ashes of the abhorrent reality of our country's encampment, the games that make children pawns, the ugly distractions that are words on jackets, so we forget words in policy, these were not new times, Stephanie reminded me. Being black in Jim Crow America, African in want for colonization, was the same to be an Israelite in Judea. And to be brown, a brown child on the border today, and to be a brown child on your ancestral land in the face of capitalism throughout the history of this country, and to be a child of color on the auction block was to be an Israelite in Rome. But it's not only the cruelty that we can point to time and again. Our wisdom sources, the Unitarian Universalist wisdom sources, also remind us that when King at Jesus' birth, you know this story, at least from our Christmas Eve time together, when he sent the wise ones to the rumored baby king, they brought him gifts instead and went home a different way. The world's sacred texts also remind us that when the Pharaoh demanded that all male babies of Israelite women be killed, it was the midwives, the Egyptian midwives, who saved them, who held their babies and families together, who nurtured hope after innocent, sacred, vulnerable life was born. Throughout our history, thousands of years, peoples and cultures, stories and truths, whispered and written, good people have broken bad laws, and from such empires have fallen. To be clear, Stephanie did not text me all of this. It's that I could hear in her simple retort, in her two lines that seemed to come with ease, that my friend had decided she could be clear. She had never forgotten or been taught to forget. In fact, her faith had given her the language that this awakening to the realities of America as empire, to the possibility, a terrifyingly unknown deconstruction of being great, might just make a new construction possible from among a different people, from not only the oppressed, but those who identified with them. Last Sunday, someone asked in the question box service how my experiences these 4 years with you all has differed from the expectations I had. And many of you heard me speak about how, like colleagues who began new ministries the Sunday after 9/11, I know our time together is vastly different than those lovely first years I knew as ministry before my time at Washington Crossing. Because my first Sundays here with you all, Ferguson, Missouri, was on fire. And because of men like Trayvon Martin and Michael Brown, and Eric Garner and Tamir Rice and Philando Castile, and we should continue on, and the people who would not let their bodies go quietly into the earth. I don't know where we'd be today, what I'd be preaching on, what programs would be enriching our lives if 4 years ago white America wasn't forced to awaken to the realities of our country. But I don't know the spirit, how the spirit would have moved us, what it would have demanded of us, what delicious cookies we would be having with our shared warm milk if the election had gone a different way 2 winters ago, or if his actions were not more grotesque than feared. But I dare say, yanked from our waters or from the expectation that our lives must assimilate to swim, we've been given the opportunity to have a ministry that matters, and not only to our own beloved tribe, but of and in the world. Dr. James Cone said in his 1969 text, Black Theology and Black Power, being black in America has little to do with skin color. Being black means that your heart, your soul, your mind, and your body are where the dispossessed are. There are children in our country, once again, whose lives will forever be marked with a number and a memory of separation. That's where we are today. It doesn't mean any of the other atrocities have quieted or submerged underground, but with every wail and rage and defiance we make and declare it as faithful, with every promise that we will not look away from the public punishment that some try to normalize, justify, beautify, each time we breathe hope into the world by breaking down the power of bad laws and cruel leadership, it is one more step toward the possibility of an empire falling. And not for the sake of deconstruction, but for the creative and divine reconstruction that could be liberation, the very essence of divine activity. Adrienne Rich wrote simply, "My heart is moved by all I cannot save. So much has been destroyed, I have to cast my lot with those who age after age perversely with no extraordinary power, reconstitute the world. For all the prophets we've known, and for the way they speak beyond their absence, for this season that calls us into a broken world, and for all the beauty that still resides there, for the wise ones who create new paths and the midwives who birth hope into the world, for you and us who can do the same, even amidst our rage, even amidst our pain, for you and us and the human family hurting and hurtful, for they will know the power of how we love. May it be so.